episode of Pit Lane Parlay.
Welcome to another episode of Pit Lane Parlay. My name is host Mike Jokum. Jess and Matt are joining me tonight. Guys, how are we on this lovely evening?
Good.
I'm cold.
I am enjoying the weather, but we'll save that topic for another day. First off, before we dive into anything, just a quick shout out to fellow media member Marshall Pruitt and his wife. Has his wife just got out of the hospital, I think, the other day after surgery for her cancer. There is a GoFundMe that, you know, most of the IndyCar community has been posting about to donate to their medical bills. So we hope his wife is recovering quickly, and we hope to see him back at the track soon. And you'll see the GoFundMe link in our show notes and on our social medias by the time the episode releases on Friday. So with that, thoughts and prayers out to the Pruitt family, and let's dive right into Texas.
Yeah, everything that Mike said, Marshall, we're thinking of you guys and hope everything turns out okay for you guys. But moving on to Texas, pretty good race. We had a fun time watching it. I think everybody out there, for the most part, from what we saw on social media, also looked like they enjoyed it. The top five from the race, if you didn't catch it, was Joseph Newgarden, followed by Alexander Rossi, Graham Rahal, Santino Ferrucci, and Ryan Hunter-Reay. It was a pretty intriguing race with some split strategies, some really brave overtaking attempts, especially on the outsides of turns one and two, some controversial moments that we'll dive into, some takes that we'll get here as far as incidents and things like that. But we'll just dive right into Joseph Newgarden's win. Jess kind of pulled it out of the bag. Any thoughts on Joseph Newgarden's win?
Meh. I feel like, I don't know. I mean, it was okay. Like, I thought it was good for him. I mean, he kind of got the monkey off of his back with the mile and a half ovals, but I don't know. I wasn't like super excited for him. I know that sounds terrible, but I was like, meh, whatever.
Yeah, I'm going to say that Joseph Newgarden needs to buy Tim Cindric any sort of gift, whether it be a car or a house or a watch or an Xbox or whatever he wants, because now it's, you know, two weekends in a row that Cindric has made just a perfect strategy call to get Newgarden to the front.
To me, it's been the third or fourth win in Joseph's tenure with Cindric that they like just completely pulled one out of the bag. And for that kind of strategy call to go their way again is obviously like good for Newgarden and his championship hopes. But at the same time, it's like, you know, not saying he didn't deserve the win, but it's almost like, you know, he didn't really run the best race per se. They just got that right strategy call that worked in their favor. And, you know, all props to him because, you know, all the other teams can do it as well. It's just they get it right. So, you know, good for them. But, you know, as far as that final restart, Mike, you know, he really, you know, kind of accelerated a little bit, then stopped, then accelerated, then stopped, then went. And drivers like Graham Rahal were kind of upset after the race. Did you see any issues with that final restart that he had?
I've watched it a couple times, and yeah, he kind of stops and starts a little bit, but I don't really have a big problem with what he did. It's the leader's discretion on when to go once the pace car lights are out. So if you're not paying attention and you accidentally, you know, hit the back of somebody's tire, like, you know, I think Rahal touched Pagano there a little bit. Thankfully, they were both able to continue. But all in all, I don't really have a big issue with it, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I really didn't have a huge issue either. I mean, it kind of is what it is. I wish they would have been a little bit more, they were bunched up, but I think that I kind of wish that everybody would have paid more attention, I guess, and gone, because I think it would have been a little more exciting. I didn't really have any issues with it. I mean, no rules were broken or anything like that. I don't think he jumped the start, nothing like that. It was just a little blah compared to what I thought it could have been, I guess.
Right. Yeah, I kind of lump it into that bucket of, you know, at a certain point in the race, things become all bets are off. But especially like Jess said, it's not really against the rules either. It's maybe more of just frowned upon, but not against any specific rules. So yeah, that was fine. But the other most controversial, well, probably the most controversial moment of the race was Scott Dixon and rookie Colton Herta battling for what I believe was second place. Herta made a pretty daring move to the inside and Dixon was having none of it. So began to come down the track and then the two collided into turn three and they were both out of the race. Just racing incident, Herta at fault, Dixon at fault. I mean, what was your kind of assessment of that whole situation?
So I might take the less than popular viewpoint here. I 100% think Dixon was at fault. Leading up to that moment, he, in my opinion, was blocking. It was not proactive moves. And then I think that he clearly could tell that Herta was there. I mean, Herta definitely had a run leading up to that point, and he tried to squeeze him and maybe didn't realize how far down he squeezed him, but I definitely think he knew what he was doing.
Yeah, this is a tough one, and another one I watched about 67 times since the race ended to see if I could figure anything else out. And, you know, I can see people making the argument, not that I would agree with it, that maybe Colton could have been more patient for, you know, another lap or so to set Dixon up. But I think he set Dixon up well enough that, you know, about 80% of Herta's car was alongside of Dixon. So at that point, you know, contact falls to the you know, guy on the outside, in this case, Dixon. So I do think it was Dixon's fault. I don't think you know, there was really any fault of Herta other than saying maybe he got too aggressive and if he waited a lap he would have made it. But I applaud Herta for you know, getting gutsy in there and making the move.
Yeah, kind of to your last point, I think, you know, 50% of me, you know, kind of prescribes it to two drivers just really racing hard. But I think your guys' assessment of it, you know, if we had to pin it on one driver in particular, I would pin it on Dixon. And, you know, kind of with the whole Pagano at Indianapolis thing, you know, Pagano was making proactive moves to block the draft from Rossi. And it's not like Rossi was underneath of him versus at this point, you know, Herta was underneath Dixon clearly. And so at that point, there's obviously an intent there to try and block him out. So at the end of the day, I do, if I had to pick one, I would pin that on Dixon. But kind of part two to that situation is actually a fan question from Patreon member Mark Van Niekerk, who's at M Vanny, ending in IE on Twitter. Appreciate the question, Mark, and all of your support. Mike, he wanted to know if you had any issues with Herta's driving either at Texas or so far this season. I know a couple of drivers were, we'll say, a little less than pleased with some of the driving he showed at practice at Indy with being a little aggressive. You know, has he been dangerous so far this season, or was he being dangerous at Texas from your point of view?
Was he being dangerous? No. You know, like I just said, you know, a minute or two ago, his 80% of his car was alongside of Dixon. So if you're, you know, you're not sticking a nose in there at the last second in the corner and causing the issue. But overall, whether it be Indy practice or at any other point, we've seen Herta's MO, which I think has continued up from his, you know, couple of years in Indy Lights. He's aggressive and he's not afraid to make a move, and you know, he understands the consequences. I have no issue with it. I know some veteran drivers may feel like that's, you know, he's not showing respect, but listen, I applaud everything he's done so far this year. He hasn't had a lot of luck lately, but you know, in terms of his driving or his driving style, I have absolutely no issue with it at all.
Heck no, me either. I mean, to be quite frank, a lot of these veteran drivers used to be more aggressive also. And so I don't fault him at all. I actually really enjoy watching him be aggressive. I mean, I think it's fun for, you know, just about anybody to watch him work his way around the field, be it lapped cars or actually fighting for positions. I think he's done an excellent job. I think he's just hasn't had that, what we like to call, you know, the big one or whatever. So he hasn't lost his fearlessness yet. And I personally don't have any problem with anything that he's doing.
My one knock on Herta coming out of Indy Lights was the fact that a couple races in Indy Lights, he threw away based on a mistake that he had, usually a crash of some sort. And to my personal opinion, we just haven't seen that in IndyCar. You know, he got wrecked at Grand Prix, this last one at Texas. You know, again, like we've said, we kind of put it more on Dixon than Colton. So, yeah, I have no problem with what he's done either. And I think, you know, for other drivers to say he's dangerous, kind of like what they were saying is that, you know, he's a rookie and rookies tend to be a little more aggressive. So maybe it's a kind of a wake-up call for the other drivers, especially since, you know, a lot of times they don't have to deal with rookies at the front of the field too often. But, yeah, Colton's done a great job so far this year. And I don't think he's been dangerous at all. So, you know, I hope he keeps it up because he's been really fun to watch. And I think other people are also catching on to the fact that he's been really fun to watch so far this year. There was two other accidents, both coming out of turn two. One was with Zach Veach, third or about halfway through the race. Came out of turn two, brushed the wall, and actually did a really good job of not making more damage out of the car. Saved it pretty well. And the other was James Hinchcliffe, who tagged the wall, then hit the inside wall, and both were running pretty well. I think Veach was somewhere around ninth, and Hinch was somewhere either in the top five or just outside the top five when they crashed. Jess, you know, both incidents, obviously unfortunate for both drivers, and their points were affected subsequently. Which accident do you feel had a bigger impact on the driver as far as being more of a letdown?
I feel like probably Hinch, honestly. I feel like he was really, you know, having a pretty good evening going for him. And it just kind of was, well, like you said, it was just a letdown. And it was very unfortunate. So I think I'll pick Hinch with this one.
All right, that's fair. So, because I don't want to agree with you, I'm going to go with Veach. I think this was, you know, after two solid, eighth place finishes in Detroit, he Veach, you know, qualified in the top 12, I believe. I forget where, for Texas, and was running, you know, in the top 10. Really looked like he was coming on to have a strong second half of the race, and then just, you know, tapped the wall. And I mean, obviously, the save he did to not damage it more was insane, but you know, Veach needs all the momentum he can, you know, get to propel himself to a better second half, and this did not help.
Yeah, I'm also going to say Veach in that, you know, kind of like you're saying, you know, he needs some good results to kind of show fans why he should be at Andretti Autosport. But then, to a different effect, you know, he was running really well at Texas this year. He was running really well at Texas last year. Kind of made the same mistake last year, coming out of turn two, brushed the wall. Wasn't forced to retire, if I remember correctly, but basically went five laps down to fix the toe and the suspension. Basically ruined his whole race, even though he was absolutely flying at Texas last year. And I know he was super hyped this year for Texas because he thought he was going to do well again. So, pretty bummed for him. I had both in Fantasy IndyCar and Dixon.
So did I.
Wasn't my best day. And then, you know, I had Rahal and Pagenaud when they touched in the final restart. I about had a heart attack. I was like, are you serious? All five of my guys are going to crash tonight. So it could have been a lot better for me. But, you know, that's fine. I'm just glad everybody was okay. So moving on, we got another incident. This one actually happened in the pits. Takuma Sato, who was actually leading early on, I've watched the replay a couple of times. He came to the pits, you know, at the speed limit, obviously. But then when he pulled in his pits, he was very quick. I just don't know if he missed his spot and then tried to turn in and unfortunately hit one of his crew guys, who's thankfully okay. He actually just got up and tried to roll the car back to the pit lane. So thank goodness he was all right. And then, you know, obviously there was the time penalty of getting the car back and doing all the, you know, tire changes, things like that. But then he also had a drive-through. But to see an incident like that where someone could seriously be hurt, Mike, A, do you have any reactions to the incident? And B, do you think there needs to be a harsher penalty than just a, you know, a drive-through penalty for that kind of incident?
First off, the crew guy whose name is escaping me, Chris Welch, maybe, is, am I close?
Correct.
Yes, thank you. Is a total badass. You know, bounced up after smacking his head on pit lane. One, thank God for the helmet. Two, and he's like, all right, I'm ready to go. Come on, let me back in. That's, you know, major props to him for just bouncing back up like that. And thank God he was okay. I don't know, you know, how Sato overjudged it that badly, unless he just was looking at the wrong pit lane, which, you know, maybe as it, yeah, I guess that could happen. So, you know, that's my guess, is maybe he was looking at the wrong pit box and then realized at the last second. Do I think there should be a harsher penalty? No, maybe you add a, I don't know, post-race monetary fine for the, you know, potentially injuring a crewman, but the penalty is the drive through and the fact that, you know, he fell two laps down just because they had to, you know, get the crew guy out of the way, get the car back in the right pit box, and, you know, make sure there was no damage. So I don't think you need to add anything else to that.
I will agree with you on the penalty. It doesn't need to be any worse than it was. I mean, I guarantee that Sato was in the car feeling awful. So he pretty much essentially had his race ruined just with the pit stop. And then he had to do a stop and go, which put him even further behind. So I think that penalty was, you know, I mean, I think that was fair, honestly. As far as what I think happened in the incident, I feel like maybe he got a little confused after the sunset and it was starting to get darker, and maybe he just misjudged it entirely. I'm super glad that Chris is, you know, for all intents and purposes, he's okay. He didn't have any major injuries, no broken bones, anything like that. So that's super impressive. And like I said, I feel like Sato, you know, personally sitting in that car after he had that happen was probably beating himself up. So I don't really think that he needed anybody else to beat him up for him.
Yeah. And, you know, like we've all said, you know, glad everybody was okay in that incident, but, you know, the reason that this year Sato has distinguished himself more than he has in the past is that he's been very consistent this year. He hasn't made these kind of mistakes. You know, he's always known for a bonsai move here or there, but so far this year, it just hasn't been there. You know, he's been very consistent, been very good, high in the points, things like that. Third in Indianapolis, win at Barber, and, you know, leading into this one and then coming into the pits and making that mistake is just kind of, you know, kind of back to that old Sato that makes those mistakes and, you know, ultimately shoots himself in the foot. So, yeah, glad everybody was okay, but I'm really bummed for Sato because, you know, obviously this isn't the end of his championship or anything like that because we still got plenty of races to go, but this definitely doesn't help, especially when you're in the lead. But enough doom and gloom. We're talking about crashes and pit incidents and things like that. Two positives to kind of touch on here was, one, Santino Ferrucci, the rookie, continues to lead the Rookie of the Year and finished fourth. Really good run for Dale Coyne Racing and, you know, really turning a lot of heads in IndyCar and the paddock and fans and whatnot. That he's, you know, he's continually doing really good on the track and putting in really solid performances. He's finished all but two laps this season, so really good to see that. The other was Connor Daly, filling in for Max Chilton on the oval here, finished 11th. You know, kind of figured out in practice that the car may not be where he likes it. Carlin's had their struggles this year and whatnot. For Daly to come out, finish 11th, bring it home in one piece, you know, have a pretty respectable race. Jess, is there, between Daly and Ferrucci, do you think there's one over the other as far as who impressed you more?
Oh, gosh, that's a tough one between those two.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, man, you know, as much as I really loved watching Ferrucci do what he did, I have to say, I think Daly impressed me more in this race only because, you know, leading up to it, it was just like, oh, I'm just gonna kind of ride along, get some info, see what happens. And he ended up doing, you know, fairly well. I mean, he obviously wasn't like on the podium or anything. He finished 11th, but I still think that given the situation, he had one heck of a day.
Well, in that case, not that you're wrong, but you're wrong. I'm going to go with Santino, you know, going 18th to 4th on an oval that you've never been on before this weekend is insanely impressive. I look back and the only time he's had any sort of incident all year is when he overshot the corner in Long Beach and stalled his car and you know, went a lap or two down in the process. Those are the only two laps he hasn't finished all year. You know, do I think that will continue? Listen, people get unlucky. Look at Colton Herta. He went from rookie of the year for the first couple races to, you know, now he's like 16th in the standing and most of it's been just bad luck. But, you know, to go 18th to 4th, he led 20 laps the second Detroit race and, you know, finished 7th in the Indy 500. He's really turning a lot of heads and I think he's been insanely impressive so far.
Yeah, no disrespect to Santino. Everything you said was correct, and he's been doing a great job this season. But just given what the state of Carlin has been so far this season, Kimball retired with a mechanical. Memory serves me, I don't think he was running all that great prior to that. And this wasn't like Daly in 2017. He finished in the top 10, but there was, you know, a 7 or 8 car crash that Daly avoided and pretty much just survived to finish in the top 10 with Foyt. So it wasn't like, you know, he was actually there, but you know, to finish 11th when, you know, only like 5 or 6 cars retired from the race and he wasn't just there because everybody else, you know, DNF'd. To me, I, you know, that's very impressive. And to me, hopefully, you know, funding working out and whatnot, he can at least get one more oval in for those final three that the cars vacated for. But yeah, Connor looked great. Hopefully we see more of him full-time, hopefully next year, fingers crossed. But for the very least, he's definitely proving to teams out there that he still has, you know, the talent, just kind of waiting for that that ride to open up. Finally here, just real quick, the fans on Twitter voted for, I believe it was Alexander Rossi as the driver of the day. Mike, Rossi, whomever, who was your driver of the day for Texas?
Oh boy. Yeah, I can't argue with Rossi. He had a beast of a car all day. Without a Tim Cindric strategy call, he has another race, a second weekend in a row, has a race stolen from him by Tim Cindric. So I will go with the easy one here and pick Rossi.
Well, since you stole my pick, I'm going to go with the one who quietly came out of nowhere and wound up on the podium, and that's Graham Rahal. I think he just kept it clean, paid attention to what was going on around him, and ended up with a really good finish for himself.
I'll go with Colton of the Americas, Colton Herta. Seems like he does pretty well in Texas for whatever reason, but for that accident to happen kind of robbed him of what was a really good performance, did very well, made some really good moves. And, you know, honestly, we could pick a bunch of drivers of the day from the race. Obviously Newgarden as well, but Herta, just because he was pretty fun to watch, a lot of daring moves, and ultimately got robbed of what would have been a good finish for him. With that, we got a couple more Texas topics to touch on a little bit here, but for now, we'll throw it to Mike for some Patreon shout outs.
Yeah, thank you to everybody who continues to subscribe. There was plenty of great content up there this weekend. Thanks to Mike Knapp, and thanks to Mike Knapp also for subscribing. Thanks to Mike Silver, Sean Crawford, Mr. Stephen Clark, our best friend, that's not the author, Stephen King, Jess's dad, Steve, and Matt's brother-in-law, Tyrone. So thank you to everybody.
All right, guys. So I've got, well, it's not really the first fan question. I was getting ready to say the first one. It's the second fan question of the evening. Our friend David Lighting, who is getting married this weekend, congrats. He wants to know, do we prefer the Texas race from this weekend, or do we prefer the one that we saw in 2016? Matt, go ahead.
Yeah, there's been a lot of takes on this one. You know, Miller's mailbag was full of a bunch of takes. Jay Fry came out and commented. Jim Aiello had a really good take on it. And so kind of just taking it all in, digesting it, rewatching the race, I prefer what we saw on Saturday. It was, you know, not extremely hard for drivers to pass. However, it took a lot of skill for them to execute passes. It wasn't like lining them up in a row and passing like it is at the Indianapolis 500 for the last couple of years of the aero kits, or at like a pack type race like Fontana or Texas from yesteryear. It took a lot of skill for drivers to pass, but it wasn't impossible. So for me, I really liked what we saw. And hopefully if, you know, weather permits, things like that, if they keep the same aerodynamic pieces and whatnot, that we get this in the future as well, because it was really fun. And before Mike goes, shout out to David. Congrats to you and Michelle.
Yeah, obviously congrats, David and Michelle, both awesome people who I look forward to seeing in Road America in a little over a week. I agree with Matt. You know, Saturday was a race of skill, still plenty of passing. But, you know, as you saw Rossi there trying to get by Newgard in the end, I don't know if it was just because he, you know, couldn't get it done, or the second lane didn't really come in as expected as that got cooler, but you had to make your passes count and you really had to work hard for them. And there was still plenty of action. So I really enjoyed Saturday's race. I thought it was a really good race. And, you know, as I've said this to, I think, Jess a few times, if my dad, who's a pretty tough critic on these new aero kits and races, if he enjoys it, it's probably a good race. And I got a 2-word text message from him when he watched it, and it said good race, which is a good sign for IndyCar. And I'll jump right into, oh, Jess, did you want to give your opinion? I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
I mean, maybe.
I'm sorry, I got excited to go with Steven's next question here. So,
Okay, so, well, I'll keep it short and sweet because I'm actually going to agree with you both. I thought it was a really good race. I mean, obviously, it wasn't like the Texas of yesteryear, as you called it, Matt, but it was still a lot of fun. The only thing I think I would have changed is to, like I said before, bunch it up a little bit more at the end to make it a little more fun for the finish, because, you know, Texas is usually known for its crazy, insane finishes, and it was kind of a letdown this year.
Fair enough. Now I will jump into Steven's question. Steven asks, what helped the race become more exciting in the second half? The fact that it got dark and cooled down, or the cautions resetting the field? Jess, since I cut you off, I will let you go first here.
I am going to say the cautions. Honestly, I don't think it cooled off as much as, you know, everybody would have liked, because I think that would have made it a little more crazy. So I think that the cautions definitely helped.
I could be a complete moron here because I actually don't have the stats in front of me here. But, you know, obviously with the nighttime coming in, the ambient temperature may not have come down as much, but I think the track temperature probably decreased significantly. Again, I'm spitballing, I don't know for certain, but I think the nighttime always helps tracks, especially in summertime, get more grip, let drivers kind of adventure more to the outside and make some of the daring moves that we saw. It's not entirely just because of that, but I think it really helps. So I'm going to go with the nighttime.
Well, I'm going to split the middle here, because I think Jess is right in the fact that the cautions did help. Matt is right that the, you know, track temperature did come down, although I don't think it came down as much as maybe some guys were expecting. So I'm going to say it was a 1-2 combination of, you know, it getting a little bit cooler and the cautions. Now, if it, you know, I think Jess said this, but if it had really cooled down, then it definitely would have been a super crazy finish.
I'm not sure that you're allowed to pick both, but okay.
I pick one. Two.
Make the rule.
All right, guys. So I'm sure that you have all seen it by now. If you haven't, I'd be shocked. We all know that Texas is the home of AJ Foyt. I mean, I don't think anybody, that's news to anyone. However, you know, of course, during his interviews, which he had a lot of, he was talking about next year and how things are going this year, and quite frankly, he is disgusted. I don't have the video pulled up, but I'm sure we will post it on our social media. But he's frustrated. I can't blame him. I would be also. He says that they are not going to tolerate what's going on their team anymore. Basically, I mean, they need to kind of start over. They're saying they're going to think outside the box. They're already looking at 2020. And their speculation is that TK is definitely going to be back, and so is ABC. So that's good to know. What do you guys think? I mean, do you think that they're going to be able to kind of get it together for 2020?
I'll let you go first, Matt.
I mean, I was hoping Mike would go first. Mine is just going to be doom and gloom and full of misery and despair, because I have no faith in this team whatsoever. Just looking at them historically, it's just, it's never gone their way. I mean, you know, shout out to Kenny Brack, Jess's favorite driver. I mean, that was all of that. And when they had Ayrton Dare, they were pretty good back in the IRL days. And then they had a couple glimmers of hope with Sato, and Vitor Mira had like a couple of good races. Ryan Hunter-Reay had one or two good races when he was with them for 1 year. But God, this team, I swear, it's just year in and year out. It's almost like the one thing you can count on is that Foyt is going to be somewhere towards the back of the field. So I don't know why it's just now taking them to wake up and go, maybe we should change things. So I'm a little less than optimistic that they are going to make wholesale changes. But, you know, it's good to see AJ kind of with that passion, that fiery attitude, saying, you know, this is dumb and we got to do something because, you know, we're not going to tolerate it. And I appreciate that out of him. I just hope we can see that translate onto track next year.
Yeah, this is the first time I can remember, I mean, in at least a year or two, where AJ has come out. You know, he was pretty blunt, and I think that was during the qualifying interview that he said that.
Yep.
Yeah, no, I think so.
No pressure on the drivers as you're about to qualify.
And then TK, you know, brushes the wall.
Yeah. Listen, I think Scott Harner and Larry Foyt taking the let's go way outside the box for the rest of this year, and at the same time, you know, apply some focus for 2020 is probably their best shot if they have any hope of being successful in 2020. I don't think we can count on much for them for the remainder of 2019, like Matt said. And I don't know what the issue is, because whether it's an engineer change or a driver change, they've mightily struggled. And it sucks because, you know, you don't want to see somebody like AJ Foyt, you know, man a team that's just so bad. But I think 2020, you know, I have a little bit of hope, but, you know, I'm not going to call it doom and gloom like Matt did, but man, it's, I guess, you know, listen, whatever you're doing right now isn't working, going the complete opposite direction and going outside the box is probably your only option.
I'm going to be that weirdo right now, guys. I'm going to say that they are going to come back swinging. I think they're going to kind of, for lack of a better word, kind of write off this year, kind of just let it be what it's going to be. It's not going to be good, obviously. And I think they're going to come back in 2020 and they're going to come back fighting. I think they, you know, may make some team changes, and may come back, you know, ready to go, and maybe we'll see them do really well.
Well, not to cut off Mike here, but Jess, as far as kind of looking forward to 2020, would you have like maybe a realistic goal you would want to see them accomplish, like a couple podiums, top 10 in the championship, anything like that?
I was going to say maybe one of their cars, if they still choose to run two, maybe one of their cars is going to finish top 10 in the championship. I think that would be a victory for them. I mean, you know, maybe eighth or ninth would be a really solid season for them.
That would be a win.
Yeah, I can't argue that. Props to Jess for going out on a limb on that one. So segueing slightly, staying on the Foyt topic here, fan question from Brandon Wagner, Twitter @IndyCar_27. With the news that Kanaan is likely to be back for 2020, what do you guys think about Kanaan being with Foyt in 2020? Does he bring a lot to the team? And listen, Jess, you're on a roll, so you're up first.
Yeah, I mean, I think that he brings a lot of good information about how the cars should be working. I feel like he just needs to have a team around him that is able to give him exactly what he's looking for. So I definitely don't think that it hurts the team keeping Tony. I think he just needs kind of I don't say somebody that listens to him, because I don't know that they don't listen to him now. I just feel like there's some, we'll call it some discombobulation in the team somewhere. There's something just not clicking, but I think that with the right team around him, TK is still got a lot of talent.
Do we know officially if he has the most starts in IndyCar history? Or I know he passed AJ, but...
No, he's like second. Yeah.
I think Mario, yeah, right. I thought Mario did like... Didn't Mario have like 400 and something?
Yes, 400 and... I think it was 467 or 469, something. I mean, he's like way, way below him still.
They call me the encyclopedia, and then Jess rolls out that I think you guys gave me the wrong nickname here. I think that belongs to Jess. I didn't know that. That's a good stat.
I saw it on Twitter, so take it with a grain of salt, because it could be wrong.
You can humble brag. It's okay. It's okay to be smart. Anyways, the fact that he's got either the second or third most starts in IndyCar history, combined with the fact that he's a champion, Indy 500 winner, you know, things like that. It's hard to say that he doesn't bring a lot to the team. It's just tough, because, you know, if you put a veteran driver who's done everything and seen everything into a car that's, we'll politely say, less than ideal, there's only so much they can do. I mean, you know, he shows up at Andretti, he shows up at Ganassi, you know, they got a pretty good setup sheet going already, and it's kind of his job to fine tune it. But to come to kind of a blank slate, you can't ask him to make lemons out of lemonade. So I don't know if it's necessarily, you know, his fault that the team's not improving, because there's a lot that goes into it. Unfortunately, I just don't know enough about behind the scenes and how everything works, and if he's working well with Mateus and things like that. I wouldn't change him out. I think he's earned kind of that respect and whatnot to kind of give him the benefit of the doubt heading forward, and that he is helping the team until proven otherwise, because he and Mateus are kind of sort of at the same level results-wise. So I would keep him for 2020, which it sounds like it's what they're going to do.
Yeah, I mean, the guy's been around long enough that he knows a lot. You know, even if the car is struggling, he knows a lot about the different tracks and can help Mateus, you know, grow for the future, even if it's not with Foyt. And I did like that when some people in the Facebook world were saying he's washed up, he actually commented back and said, listen, I'm not in this for the money. I'm in this to make this team more successful, and I'll do whatever it takes. So, you know, if the passion is still there, he's bringing a lot to Foyt in 2020. So, you know, I look forward to seeing him back, and I do hope they have a better 2020 than they've had in the past couple of years. Moving on, Adam Stern came out a couple days ago and said that IndyCar will not be headed to any of the international venues suspected for 2020, which I kind of expected. I don't know about you guys, since it's, you know, the middle of the year and we hadn't heard anything, and with everything that needs to take place for any track repairs anywhere, you know, you need at least a good year, I would guess. You know, example would be the Surfers Paradise rumor. So, you know, is this good for IndyCar? Is this bad for IndyCar? And I'll wrap it up with, do you think any of them will be on the schedule by 2021? And we'll start with Matt this time.
Fingers crossed Surfers Paradise happens in 2021. Kind of a bummer it's not happening next year. But I don't necessarily think it's bad for IndyCar, because for them to, I think they're a little gun shy, for them to kind of rush into things, it's not worked in the past for the international events. Most recently, Brazil in 2015, I think, and China 2012. Both fell through without actually hosting an event. So I think if they are going to do it, they want to make sure they do it right. I know with Surfers, they were expecting a date. They're still negotiating that. And obviously if the report from Adam Stern is correct, you know, obviously things may not have gone IndyCar's way on that one. So I don't necessarily think it's bad for IndyCar. It gives them kind of another year to focus on the strategy and really execute it well, so that if they do come in 2021, that it's done properly.
Well, here I go again. I'm going to say because we've heard things before that we thought were for sure either going to happen or not going to happen, and they switched up on us. That I'm going to take this report with a grain of salt. I am still hopeful that we might see an international race in 2020. As far as if this is true, it being good or bad, I mean, like you said, I think they need to do it right, because obviously if they don't, you know, a poor showing of fans or whatnot could be disastrous. So I think it's kind of middle road, I guess. It's good that they're looking to do it right. It's bad because everybody thought there would be one. And then as far as, do I think if it's going to happen in 2021? Yeah, for sure. I know we're right there on the verge of having an international race. And I think I definitely don't see it dragging out more than that.
Yeah, I think, you know, the more these type of stories start popping up, the more realistic it becomes. So 2021 is a definite possibility. I don't really think it's bad for IndyCar. You know, the more in places that are interested in having IndyCar, you know, like Argentina or Venezuela or wherever it was in South America, plus Surfers Paradise, you know, you know, if people want to host IndyCar, that can't be a bad thing. So, you know, I'm a little disappointed it's not happening, but I guess, you know, considering it's already the middle of June, I'm not surprised that this announcement came out. And I guess the other rumor we should comment on is that there is a rumor that Richmond will be back on the IndyCar calendar in 2020, maybe as a Pocono replacement, maybe as another oval, but sounds more like a replacement based on Mark Miles' kind of comments. Jess, what do you think about Richmond? You know, do you want to see it added? Do you want to see it replace Pocono?
Well, of course, I'd rather see it added. But I guess if it's got to replace anything, Pocono would be my choice right now. But yeah, I'd really rather it be an addition than replacing something.
Yeah, I don't want addition by subtraction. You know, Richmond's fun and cool, and if they can make sure they don't get a single groove track like they did in 2009, I think it'd be really fun. If it had to replace an oval on the schedule, I guess I would pick Pocono. Fingers crossed, not Iowa. So would be a lot of fun to see Indy cars there.
Yeah, obviously, you know, I get the IndyCar paddock may not be thrilled with the, you know, or maybe a little scared away from Pocono after last year. But, you know, the racing before last year had been pretty good the last couple of years. I've heard ticket sales so far is significantly higher than it's been even last year and the year before. So hopefully maybe that'll sway IndyCar to continue negotiating, which I believe they are. So, you know, but listen, if Richmond is the replacement, it's a great track, and I'd be excited to see IndyCar there in 2020.
Yeah, and real quick before we get to the stump the host here, I forgot to mention that the biggest loser in this whole no international races for 2020 is actually Jess's passport. I know how
legit.
I know how excited she was to get all these stamps from Argentina and Surfers, and I think we also said Oregon, which we decided was its own country. So kind of a bummer, Jess. I don't know if you thought about that at all.
I know. It's sad. I'll just have to tuck it away again, I guess.
All right. Well, maybe 2021, fingers crossed. Or like you said, maybe next year, and then we just, you know, get a gotcha next year, and it'll be better. So, oh, who knows? But we'll keep you guys informed for sure. But moving on to Stump the Host, kind of hit me on Saturday night when I'm watching the race that, you know, we got a guy named Colton Hurd out there. We got a guy named Graham Rahal out there, and got a guy named Marco Andretti out there, and it got me thinking, when was the first time we saw a Rahal and Andretti and a Herta out on the track in the same season of IndyCar. So I guess that's my question to you guys, to whoever wants to answer, is when was the first time we saw a Herta, a Rahal, and an Andretti all contesting in the same IndyCar season?
Wow.
I wish you could see the blank look on my face right now.
Yeah.
Just, well, good news is, I mean, you got years, so can't be too, well, you can be wrong, but, you know, use your best guess here.
1998.
All right. We're in the right decade, but that's not the correct answer.
1993.
No. I should also remind you to close your Google. Go ahead, Jess.
1995.
Close.
96.
Further away.
94.
There you go. Woo! 1994 was Brian Herta's rookie season. He was racing for AJ Foyt. Actually, I believe he had a really bad crash at Toronto and had to miss the rest of the year with a hip fracture, question mark, if I remember correctly. Bobby Rahal was racing for his own team that he was the owner of, and Michael Andretti was actually racing for Chip Ganassi that season, believe it or not. Actually, kind of an interesting story about how he helped Chip Ganassi kind of get on his feet as an owner and really establish that team, but that'll be for another day. But yeah, 1994. Good job, Jess. You guys were really close, though, so you guys weren't as far off as you made it sound like by your reaction, so that's good. So good job to you guys.
I'm really good at guessing. just kidding. It'd still take three times. So I am going to throw it out to another fan question, but I'm just going to tell you guys right now that I'm taking this one first because so Andrew Barker wants to know what our biggest surprise and our biggest disappointment is so far this season. So obviously I said I'm going first. So my biggest surprise is going to be Santino Ferrucci. I thought he would do well, but I didn't think he would do as well as he is currently doing. I mean, ninth in points is insane. And finishing fourth in Texas is just amazing, considering he's never been there and Texas is such a beast. So he's going to be my biggest surprise. And then my biggest disappointment for the year, I'm going to have to go with Will Power. I know it's not all his fault, but he has been struggling this season and it's kind of hard to watch, honestly. How about Mike?
Yes, thank you. my biggest surprise, I'm going to go with Takuma Sato. You know, he seems you know, like he's really putting it all together this year. You know, three podium finishes, a win, he has two poles in the first nine races. And he's led the second most overall laps as of this weekend. Thank you to racing-reference.info for that wonderful information. My biggest disappointment, oh boy. Well, I'm going to skip the low-hanging fruit of AJ Foyt Racing and go with Felix Rosenquist, who started out the year really hot and has kind of struggled the last five to six races and hasn't really looked as competitive. I thought we'd see a little bit more fight out of him than we've seen so far this year.
Can I just throw something in there? You called AJ Foyt Racing low-hanging fruit, but I don't think they're really a disappointment. They're just...
Yeah, that's fair.
It is. They are what they are.
That's fair.
Let's see. Biggest, what do we phrase it as? Biggest surprise? So far for me, it's been actually Simon Pagenaud. I mean, the guy was pretty much written off at Penske. You know, hey, the guy's keeping the seat warm for Rossi. Things like that were being said. And, you know, comes into May, wins the Grand Prix, wins the Indy 500. Obviously, huge boost to his championship points. It's been kind of okay everywhere else, but, you know, that's honestly enough to keep him in the championship fight. So for me to finish, you know, so well at Indy and to really be a good chunk of points ahead of Will Power at the moment, I think it's definitely good for his job security and it definitely bought himself a seat for next year at Team Penske. So that's good to see. Going to switch it up here a little bit, though, for biggest disappointment. I'm going to go with Scott Dixon. He was okay at Circuit of the Americas. He was okay at Indianapolis. I mean, I know he swept up in an accident and got hit by Kimball, but or actually may have been Rosenquist, but you know, finished 17th there, but wasn't all that impressive that whole month, to be honest. You know, crashes at Detroit on his very own, and then at Texas, really, as we kind of said earlier in the episode, kind of made a unnecessary risk in blocking Colton Herta that led to his accident. It's just he's making uncharacteristic errors that I don't really see out of him, and so he's almost 100 points outside of the championship, you know, this far in the season. It's pretty rare. He usually turns it on for the second half, but, you know, he's going to start have to put in some good performances here if he wants any hope at that championship defense, because so far this year it's either gone really well or really poorly for him. So moving on, I was expecting Mike to kind of insult me there, but okay, moving on here, we got another fan question. Patreon member Michael Goodyear or Goodyear, depending
there on where you go. You're from. I was going to say you said that wrong.
at mgoodyear 007. Speaking of drivers, you know, we've been discussing a lot of drivers this episode. Haven't mentioned Spencer Pigot. Don't really talk about him too much. But what he wanted to know, Michael, was if we see Spencer Pigot leaving ECR this offseason, possibly for another team to take their ride, just went first last time. So go ahead, Mike.
I don't think so. I know he hasn't had a great year. He's had a couple, you know, good qualifying efforts and then underwhelming race efforts, whether it's been his fault or not. But, you know, just kind of looking at the landscape of 2020, there's really not a lot of full season seats out there already that are, you know, definitely available. So I think, you know, his best move is to stay with Ed Carpenter Racing.
Yeah, I can't see him leaving unless he has something absolutely 100% set in stone. And frankly, I don't feel like that happens all that much anymore, you know, without you leaving, if that makes any sense. So I feel like nobody really talks to you a whole lot unless you leave a team. And he probably doesn't want to leave his team unless he's got something lined up. So I say not anytime soon for sure. I feel like he's going to be there for a little bit, which I think is honestly a good place to be. I think they're just having a little bit of a rough year this year.
If it makes it feel any better, I understood what you're saying. So there's that. With Pigot, it's not that I don't think he shouldn't leave, because I do think if there was greener grass somewhere else that he should take it, like Ganassi, Andretti, places like that. But kind of like what you guys are saying, I just don't know if there is going to be an open seat anywhere. So if you can't improve your situation, like, you know, if the number four Foyt car opens up, I wouldn't jump at that. So if there isn't a better situation for him, then no, I would definitely not leave. And I think that is the situation that we're in. I don't think he will leave just because there won't be a better open seat for him next season.
All right, guys. So I hope you're ready for this. We're going to play a little game.
We should give this a name, though, like Jess's Fun Time or something.
I like it. I like it. Jingle. I'm not going to come up with one right on the spot, but I will do my best before the next time we play this game. And it'll be different every time because you guys can't know what's coming. So I am getting ready to kind of throw these guys just totally for a loop here. They don't know what's coming. They have no idea. And it's just for fun. So keep that in mind, guys. This is not like based on any kind of rumors or anything. This is just strictly for fun. So I'm going to give you guys two scenarios and I want to see what you're going to come up with. Okay. So the first scenario, you guys are now the director of competition for IndyCar. Congratulations.
Sorry, Jay.
I don't want to follow Jay Fry. I want to do terrible.
I'm going to let you both make one rule that's going to be added to the rule book for 2020. What's it going to be and why? Oh,
man. I'll go first if you want me to.
Yeah, go for it.
The best part about the 2011 season was the double file restarts. Oh my God, they were so much fun to watch. And they were kind of a hot mess disaster or Hot Mess Express or whatever term we're going with this week, as we've discussed, it's Jess's favorite term, but they were a bit of a hot mess disaster. They definitely put some money in the back pockets of Dallara based on some of the wrecks we saw, but they were so much fun. And I think outside of Indy, if we brought those back for road courses and ovals, it just makes the restarts absolutely bonkers. I know the fans at home loved them in 2011. I don't know necessarily about the drivers, but definitely, at least on the ovals, double file restarts would be all hoot.
So speaking of double file, one thing I've noticed over the last couple of years on start of the race is sometimes these double file starts are not exactly bunched up very well. So my rule is going to be standing starts on the road and street courses where it allows. I know I'm sure some, maybe like Long Beach, might be a little difficult, but as many as possible. So that is my rule without putting any real research into this.
You got that soundboard. Give yourself a round of applause for that one. That was beautiful.
I don't remember which button my soundboard is. Well,
don't do the adorable one, because that would be awkward. But that, I love the standing start. That definitely, that's actually, I think, better than my answer, but anyways.
So both of you all are creating carnage. Okay, I love it. All right, so now you guys have a new position with an IndyCar. You guys are now the, I don't even know what it's called, but anyways, you're the schedule maker.
Okay.
So you are adding one new track. It can be any track in the world, just anything. Just throw one out there that you would like to see IndyCar race on in 2020.
Oh, boy.
I'll go first again if you want me to.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'll do, just because I can't pick one, I'll do a road course and an oval. So for my road course, I'll die on this hill. I've said it many times on Twitter. I'll defend it. If anybody wants to know why or anything like that, feel free to message me. But Baltimore was the coolest race ever. There was so much random stuff that happened in those races. There's always dramatic moments. The winding, twisting turns through Baltimore, Camden Yards, things like that. I just loved that road course, and it was just fun. I mean, if there was a way you could take away the railroad track on the front straightaway, which is really sketchy, I know. If there's a way we could take that away, I think it would have been almost perfect. But, man, I wish we could go back to Baltimore, and I know why it ended and things like that. But it'd be really cool in an unrealistic world if we could bring that back. Oval, Michigan, 100%. I think, you know, watching the NASCARs at Michigan put on their boring race, kind of disappointing. Just because I wish IndyCars were there, and they always put on a good show there. So I really wish we could bring back Michigan. Again, unrealistic, I know, but in a fantasy world, I'd love to see it.
Very good. I'm going to throw in a nostalgia one that's, you know, so unrealistic, it's not worth talking about. In Nazareth, you know, just from, you know, growing up there, option B for a oval that could actually, IndyCar could go back to next year, I think Chicagoland would be a fun place. The races there were pretty crazy, you know, 2001 to 2010-ish. So that would be my pick there. In terms of a street or road course, I'm going to go with Watkins Glen. The races, you know, when IndyCar came back there a couple of years ago were really good. So I would love to see them back there.
Thank you both. Oh, I'm sorry.
Well, for those keeping track at home, if Miller's mailbag was voting, it would be Cleveland and Milwaukee.
I was going to say, I just want to thank you both for not saying Milwaukee. Moving on. Mike, it's your turn.
Okay. Let's see here. All right. So Rahal Letterman-Lanigan released Graham Rahal's beautiful tribute livery for Road America next weekend, the Miller Genuine Draft. Car from back in the the 90s, which is one of my favorite all-time liveries. So, ladies and gentlemen, first off, your thoughts on the livery. Do you think we should see more of this? And if you had to pick one livery throwback to re-enter IndyCar for whatever driver, what would it be?
Oh, Lord. Well, okay, so I think it's cool. I think it looks really good. Should we see more of it? I mean, yes and no. As long as I do it right, they're really cool. But if it gets to be like hokey, then no. And then as far as what would my perfect throwback be, like, you guys shouldn't even have to ask this because, of course, it's going to be the Power Team number 14. I mean, that's just it.
Well, I don't know. Is it like weird of me to want to see something like that? So the one that you want, but like ABC Supply on the side, like, would that ruin it a little at all? Or
yeah, I think it would because it was just so like, I don't know. I mean, you can't see that without thinking Power Team. Like, I don't know.
Right. Because part one is, yes, I love the livery. I think it's gorgeous and perfect. Part two is, yes, I think we should see more of it. And then my third answer was, if we could see something, I'm trying to think, like, what if Clydell was on the side of the cool livery for Dale Coyne? Like, I know Coyne didn't have the cool green cars, but like, something goofy like that, because obviously you can't throw cool on the side of it anymore. Unless we throw a warning label on there saying nicotine's addictive. That might work. I don't know.
Maybe cool comes out with a new vape pen thing.
Yeah, that. The vape pen things that are sweeping.
Or CBD.
Yeah. Or that thing that I didn't know whatever it was 4 months ago and Jess schooled me on the episode about. Yeah, vape pens and CBD. If there was a way that we could get the cool car to come back in some sort of rendition of that, I'd be all for the hokey, weird throwback liveries with a random sponsor on them just for nostalgia's sake.
Yeah, as I said, I think the Ray Hell's livery looks beautiful. Job well done. Again, that's another car I need the diecast of. Still waiting for the Willpower matte black one. I do think we should see more of it, you know, maybe at a track like Laguna Seca to end the year, you get a couple more guys doing something like this. In 87, I think it was Michael Andretti ran that blue and yellow car with the had a little STP logo on it. And was it Krakow was the main sponsor?
Yep. Krakow was like 85 through 93. They ran that same color. Beautiful.
So that would be a perfect fit for, you know, Napa and Alex Rossi. Really wouldn't have to, I think, you know, the color scheme is just about the same. And honorable mention to the marble red and white. If Penske could bring that back with Verizon, I think that'd be pretty cool as well.
Oh, yes.
With that, it is time for everybody's favorite segment, Pitfalls. And I think we all have some fantastic pitfalls this week. So Jess, why don't you start us off?
Okay, so mine's going to be kind of a general pitfall or a like a blanket pitfall.
PSA.
Yeah, like, dude, okay, so I obviously am on social media all the time. Like, I think my phone is actually permanently attached to my hand at this point. So I have noticed a rather almost alarming uptick the past couple of weeks in, we're going to call it personal jabs. Like when you get in a little bit of an argument and maybe you guys are talking about one thing and then all of a sudden out of nowhere, something personal gets brought into this, for no apparent reason whatsoever. For example, I'm not going to name any names because, like I said, this is going to be kind of a blanket pitfall. There is somebody who has a lot of, we'll call them hot takes, has a lot of hot takes on Twitter. And a lot of people disagree with those hot takes, and we'll call this person out. Somebody called him out. I think it was this past week or it might have been last week. I can't remember for sure. But also brought up the fact that he previously had an addiction problem and also has a disability. Why? Like, why would you stoop that low? I mean, there's no reason whatsoever to stoop that low. I've also seen people who bring past experiences into reasons for disliking other people doesn't really make any sense to me. I mean, literally no sense at all. Just people, like, the world sucks enough. Let's be sort of civil to each other. You don't have to be friends. You don't have to be super nice, but let's not make things personal that aren't actually personal.
Applause, soundboard.
All right, Matt, you're up.
Yeah, I agree with Jess there. Mine kind of, shout out to Carrie, Patreon member, who kind of also wanted to know our thoughts about the F1 race in Montreal. Well, here you go, Carrie. The pitfall for me is the F1 stewards for one of the most ridiculous penalties I've ever seen in my entire life. It's absolutely absurd. As someone said on social media, if Mario Andretti is calling you guys out, you know you did something wrong. If you didn't catch it, Sebastian Vettel left the track after kind of locking up his brakes, came back onto the track, and was trying to control his car. In the same moment, Lewis Hamilton was trying to get around him but had to brake pretty heavily to avoid contact. And so they gave Vettel a 5-second penalty for an unsafe re-entry. As I'm saying all this, I'm shaking my head and wiping my eyes because I'm disgusted just talking about it, because it was just one of the worst penalties I've ever seen. Yes, Vettel made a mistake locking up and leaving the track, but at that point, he has no control over his car. So when he's getting back onto the track and opposite locking to make sure he doesn't hit the wall, he's not thinking about Lewis Hamilton or where he is or trying to block him. So for me, it was a terrible decision. It was something that people have been digging through other races and finding same instances where they weren't penalized. And to me, it's just over-stewarding races to the point where it's, I mean, it was already a bad race to begin with, but that just honestly made it unbearable. And it's a stain on F1 right now, and they've been kind of in damage control. And my favorite was they were asking fans for feedback about the race on their official Twitter account. Of course, how do you think that worked? It was just brutal, and I don't think I saw a single person agree with it. And somebody, I think it was Hinch on Prude's podcast, was answering a question about it, and he said, you know, for Hamilton to say, yeah, I pressured him into that mistake. If you pressured him into it, you should also be aware of the fact that if you're thinking he's going to make a mistake, you should probably be prepared for what the next step is, which is to pass him. And I think Hamilton incorrectly tried to go into the outside when he should have really gone to the inside. So part of that's on Hamilton too, for not correctly guessing which way to go. But that's my two cents. And yeah, I think Mike's is actually better than mine.
Before we get there, I don't know, does Jess have any F1 thoughts?
I'm going to be honest, I didn't even watch it. I read all of the craziness afterwards, and I'm kind of glad I didn't watch it, to be honest.
You're not missing much.
Yeah, let's just say I dozed off, woke up, laughed because I saw Sebastian Vettel got a penalty, and then realized what happened and was extremely disappointed. I don't know how your entry is unsafe when you're going through grass. And a couple people pointed out that Lewis Hamilton did something similar a few years ago and didn't get a penalty, and so on and so forth. Speaking of F1, we're going to get to my pitfall now, which is the gift that keeps on giving, other than Williams Racing in Rich Energy, who has had a complete Twitter meltdown this week. I feel like if their Twitter account was a person right now, they'd be a child having a meltdown in public. But the White Bikes Twitter account, who has some sort of relationship with Mercedes, tweeted a picture of a Mercedes F1 sort of poster thing. And Rich Energy replied, "Enjoy the free PR while you can. Those with a higher IQ than their age realize you are Mickey Mouse. Blah, blah, blah. We are actually investing money in F1 whilst you are investing zero. Total parasites. Knew about us 2 years before piping up." Okay, so that alone is embarrassing, childish, as I just mentioned, and laughable. The comments on Twitter have been just so fantastic from everybody. And Rich Energy is just attacking pretty much anybody who tweets at them. They're, you know, a writer from the UK who Rich Energy talks about. The UK, you know, your analysis doesn't support UK car companies. And instead of saying like Aston Martin, you know, a car company that, you know, most people know, they pick Ultima Cars, which is a very small sports car company. It's just really, really embarrassing for a UK company whose drink tastes exactly like Red Bull, despite the we are better than Red Bull hashtag. And their hashtags, I mean, it's just embarrassing. And probably the best part is us F1 driver Romain Grosjean is spotted in a picture on Twitter from, I guess, a couple years ago on a white bike. If that isn't a slap in the face of Rich Energy, I don't know what is. Also, the fact that a couple people mentioned online that we think Rich Energy is actually made in Austria, where Red Bull is. And we could go on for a long time about this one, obviously, but I'm going to leave it at that and just continue to laugh at Rich Energy self implode. I hope whoever is running their Twitter account never gets fired until the company disappears. They are providing days and days and days of entertainment. And if you haven't followed, there is now an account called Fake Rich Energy One, which is really funny to follow as well. So any thoughts, guys?
Well, kind of like I told you and kind of tweeted out, it's like, I honestly think it's a parody account, like 100%. Like normal corporate Twitter accounts, they just don't do what they're doing, at least as far as what I've ever seen. So to me, it's just super bizarre slash kind of funny to kind of sit back and watch. And, you know, Mike retweets a lot of them into his timelines and they're just hilarious. So it's always good fun to look at slash cringe at the same time.
So you said you thought they were made in Austria. They are. It is manufactured in Austria, says it right on the can. So, just like you said, it's basically Red Bull. And in fact, when I found it, I looked at the ingredients before I ever opened it and said, this is going to taste just like Red Bull. And hey, lo and behold, it does. Yeah, I'm scrolling down through their feed right now and it is fantastic. I'm going to give them a follow just because, yeah.
Look at that. They just got a new follower. I guess we'll leave it at that. Thank you to Rich Energy for melting down on Twitter. You have provided the internet endless entertainment. And with that, Jess, feel free to sign us off.
And guys, keep your lug nuts tight.